everyone. I'm back. I said I would be back. Still tired, of course. But here I am because I want to launch this new course properly, Foundations of Shakespeare. I'm going to be talking you through what's on this course, why you should take it, of course. I've also just knocked together this trailer. I don't know if it's going to be the final kind of promo, but for now, it will have to do. The vocals you will hear, obviously my voice is in it, but the other voice you will hear is a friend of this channel. Let's see if you can figure out who it is. And the reason why I'm not sure if it's the final cut of this is because he sent me so many little sound bites and things that I kind of want to use some of the others too. So there may be multiple versions of this advert going forward, but this is just the kind of quick and dirty one I put together like in the 10 minutes before I had this stream. So this is going to be the launch trailer for Foundations of Shakespeare.
If music be the food of love, play on.
Foundations of Shakespeare.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Oh, look, here comes Othello, talking total crap as usual.
14 lectures.
But it is a melancholy of mine own, compounded of many simples, extracted from many objects.
Buy it now! All right, there we go. It's only a short one because there we go. Hope you enjoyed that. So, all right, so let's have a look to see what's on this course altogether then. Like I said, there's a lot that's gone into this. So, and I'll also kind of answer your questions that you've got about the, if anybody's got questions about it as well. So get onto the academic agency. You'll see it looks like this. Had a bit of a makeover in line with the channel revamp. So it's got the same logo as the channel now, and it's all black. All black. And you can see that Foundations of Shakespeare takes its place alongside all the other courses: entrepreneurship, trivium, politics and economics, mathematics, physics. And if you click on Foundations of Shakespeare, I should be able to. Yes, I can see it as a student. So if you have a look to see what's on the course, you get it. There are four sections and there are 14 lectures, actually 15 lectures, if you include the little welcome note I've got in there as well. And when you click on a section, it will come up like this. So each lecture, so there's the little welcome note. You watch the video, the lecture, that's about an hour long there. Each one of those lectures is about an hour long. And then you can see the slides and the script. And then there are a set of questions that you need to do to progress to the next bit. And the course is I'm starting how to study Shakespeare. And if you want to know where it's pitched, this course, this is basically, I would say, a university level course. It's pretty much a course as taught at undergraduate level, possibly even towards the upper end of that. But it is designed for anybody reasonably intelligent to be able to do. Okay. If you're studying Shakespeare in school, if you're doing it at university level, if you're just interested in Shakespeare, if you've always wanted to know about Shakespeare, but haven't ever been bothered to find out, this is basically it. This is an introduction to really taking Shakespeare quite seriously. Now, the caveat I'll give to that is that that means that I have not in any single way tried to dumb this down for a kind of it's in depth. It really is in depth, and it starts from the ground up. So if you have a look, how to study Shakespeare, I get into some of the language, I get into some scholars and critics. I get into what to look at when you're analyzing a play. Then in this general introduction, I start to fill in some background information. Then there's a whole section on historical context where there's a lecture called Why Is It Called the Renaissance? Which is about 1,000 years worth of history in one lecture. but I kind of try to situate Shakespeare in the very, very long, in the widest possible context to understand exactly where that is in history and how you should think about what is actually happening at that moment in the 1590s. Then I zoom in and look at life and beliefs in early modern England. That is really looking at not only the kind of basics of Elizabethan life, but it's looking at feudalism, ideas inherited for the feudal era. What was feudalism? How did it break down? What was the state of play in Shakespeare's time? It's about the most in-depth coverage of that topic you're going to find anywhere, pretty much, because I really went to town on that one. And then I zoom in even further and look at specifically Shakespeare's life growing up in Stratford as a playwright, his business model, how that business model affected the work that he was doing, how it compared to the other people who were around at that time. So by the time you have reached your first play, you've already gone through 5 introductory lectures, okay? And that's something that if I was teaching this at an actual university, I'd have had to have tried to compress all of that stuff into one lecture, right? Or I wouldn't have had time to go into all of that. So there's about 5 or 6 hours worth of stuff before you even get to the first play, which is Midsummer Night's Dream, okay? And what I've done is each lecture is in 4 sections. So the first section is the sources. The second section is the dramatic structure and the genre and the structure. The third section are the contexts. That is, what are the specific contexts that this play taps into? And then the fourth are the interpretations, how to interpret, how to make sense of what this play is trying to say. What was Shakespeare even trying to say with this play? How should we take it? What's it saying about people? What's it saying about his world? What's it saying about our world? Right. And by the time you've been through all 8 of the plays, you should have a much, much better understanding of not only of Shakespeare and his world, but also about what he might have to tell, what he might have to say to us now. The plays we're looking at, Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure, and then Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth. And then there's a final note where I talk about Shakespeare's connection with the past, connection to the the history of this country and his importance to it as well. So by the time you've got through all of that, it's a huge amount of material. And this is not something you'll be able to do in one day. I recommend taking a day to read the play and to watch the play. I recommend the old BBC, the BBC Shakespeare from the late 70s and the early 80s, because they're complete. And I also recommend watching the play and reading the play at the same time. So I take a day to read and or watch the play and take it all in. Oh, by the way, did anybody guess who was in the advert? It was none other than Simon Roberts. Simon has got such a beautiful speaking voice. And I thought maybe Simon should do like all audiobooks. He should do all audiobooks. And he sent me, I only asked him for a couple of lines. He sent me, he recorded tons of stuff in crystal clear, perfect English. And I wish I'd known he was so good at reading, reading stuff like Shakespeare because I could have incorporated it more. But yeah, I will probably make 2, 3, 4 different adverts with the stuff that he sent me. So the plays we're doing, Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure, and then Hamlet, Othello, Lear, Macbeth. I said that. Yeah, so I would spend a day reading the play, taking the play in, try to watch it, think about it, you know, maybe do it with somebody else. Maybe you've got someone in your family. Or if you're, you know, part of a student group or whatever, do it together. And, yeah, take it in. Before you actually watch my lecture, then I would watch the lecture. So, you know, let's pretend we're doing Midsummer Night's Dream. I would read Midsummer Night's Dream and try to watch it. Then I would spend a different day, a second day, to take in the lecture. And then I would spend an entire third day on those questions, okay? And try to take it at that slow-ish pace. You know, that's the best part of a week. You know, if you were at university and you were doing this course, each one of these lectures would be a separate week, right? There'd be a week in between there. So I wouldn't try to, you know, like sometimes when you're on YouTube, you'll discover someone and you'll binge their content, right? This is not like watching YouTube videos. These are actual lectures. This is actually a course. You're not going to be able to get anything out of Shakespeare if you're just going to try to like binge. You can't binge Shakespeare in that way. You need to spend time thinking about what the players are doing, what they're trying to say. I think too much is made of the language barrier. One of the stats I pull up is that there are only 5% of all the words in Shakespeare are considered archaic, i.e. only 5% of all the words aren't used, right? So once you've got down a few different little things, like, I don't know, Shakespeare will say methinks. Well, what he means is I think. Or he'll say, so saith the Lord. Well, what he means is so says. You know, there's just a couple of little quirks with early modern English. But basically they're speaking English. So the language barrier is too much is made of that. And once you those couple of little things click, you'll understand exactly what he's saying very quickly. But still, these are complex plays. So you're not, you know, it's going to take you time to really understand what's going on. And then in those lectures, you know, yeah, there's some information about the various different the sources and things like that. Once I get into the genre, the structure, how the structure affects what's being said, the various different contexts and how that can actually transform how you see a play, some little historical detail that you didn't know about. Maybe this play was written for this dude's birthday or something. You know, there's usually something in there that you're not going to know about until somebody tells you. And then once I tell you, well, okay, this critic at this time said this, and then this one said that, and then this one said this, and then this one said that. You know, now you've got another like 50 things to think about. So there's quite a lot to take in. Okay, there's no like way of doing like my baby's first Shakespeare. There's no way of kind of dumbing this stuff down. And I've decided to just do it, you know, at the topmost level. So I really do hope people get the most out of it. And now I will take some questions. I mean, one of the questions I had earlier on is like, why would you want to do this? You know, it's look, I mean, the thing is, the value of literature, and especially your national bard, or, you know, if you're European, one of the great writers in European history, or even if you're Japanese or something, one of the world's greatest ever writers, if not the world's greatest ever writer, Shakespeare, the value of doing it is self-evident, okay? one of the issues and one of the reasons I've made this course, not least because my background is in Shakespeare studies, is that Shakespeare is an institution into himself, but he's also one that the left and the one that the kind of mainstream culture tries to take in. They try to gatekeep that. They try to have it. They try, and they put all their stuff in there, right? So in recent years, Shakespeare has been inundated with woke stuff and nonsense and, you know, cross-gender casting and cross-racial casting and all this sort of nonsense. And then there'll be, you know, experts, quote-unquote experts on hand to tell you, you know, this is what Shakespeare really meant by this, or this is what Shakespeare was really saying on that. And all of that stuff is an entry barrier and is actually bad. It's actually, you know, Shakespeare is, you know, he was a writer from the 1590s and the early 1600s. But even by the standards of his time, Shakespeare has, I would say, a kind of basically reactionary attitude about the developments of his time. You've got to understand, in this period, in the Elizabethan period and in James the First period, there was a lot of new wealth in the country. There was an emergent bourgeoisie and a new merchant class. There was just more money sloshing around the system. And that old feudal order was breaking down, okay? Now, obviously, the Civil War with Cromwell and all of that is another 30 or 40 years off. But the forces that set the English Civil War into motion are getting started here, okay? And Shakespeare is seeing this stuff coming. He is basically watching what we call modernity and the Enlightenment and the worship of science and Faustianism. He's seeing all of this stuff coming. And then at the same time, he's looking back. He's looking back at the old feudal order, looking back at the medieval order that Thomas Carlyle talks about in his work. And he's basically sending a warning shot. He's saying, do we want to do this? Because that old order was really good. The old chivalric values were good. And this new thing is bad. People becoming selfish, people becoming ruthlessly self-interested and greedy and, you know, are driven by their appetites, the universal wolf, he calls it. And he's worried about that. And you can see in his plays, he's grappling with all these issues. And then, of course, Shakespeare himself, ironically, was a self-made man. He was a very wealthy guy in his own time. Bought a house with 10 fireplaces. You know, he made an absolute mint selling tickets to these plays as a joint stock company holder in the Globe Theatre. And yet his sympathies are always with the old aristocratic order. And yet he can see some of the problems in that old order as well. He can see the reasons that feudalism broke down. He can see how fragile it is when, you know, you're relying on a system of honor, you know, grubby little merchants, horrible self-seeking types. They can, you know, Machiavellian foxes. They can attack that system pretty easily. And he's constantly concerned about these new forces, you know, destroying the England that he loves, which is really interesting because, of course, he's writing before all of the developments that a lot of people would think about today, you know, which have been so damaging. He's writing before any of those things took place. And yet, even in his own time, he could kind of see where things were headed. Another really fascinating thing about Shakespeare, I would say, his value of hierarchy and order, it's just everywhere in these plays. So there's some really obvious reasons that all of you guys should take a greater interest. There's another facet of Shakespeare, though, that makes him, that marks him out from all of his contemporaries, is he does have an extraordinary capacity for empathy, for being able to look at somebody who he hates, somebody who he has no, somebody who his instincts are telling him is an enemy, and yet he can see the humanity in them and actually look through their eyes. And this capacity that Shakespeare has of being able to embody somebody else and look out at the world through their eyes, give them speeches that are authentic and real, is probably the thing that marks him out above most other writers ever. He does, I mean, you know, I mentioned Shylock in that video earlier on. He does it with Shylock. I mean, clearly Shakespeare doesn't like Shylock as a character, and yet he gives him an amazing speech. Clearly Shakespeare, for example, is pretty misogynistic, right? He's very pro the patriarchy, if you want to put it in feminist terms. Not that I discuss the patriarchy. I mean, I explain the reasoning behind these hierarchies and some of the science behind it. There was a chap called Galen. I talk about the great chain of being a lot, and the kind of ideologies that held the system in place. But I don't really talk about the patriarchy on the course. I don't engage with any of the modern scholars. Nobody after 1980 do I even talk about at all, other than a couple of references here and there. But one of the things that I can say safely is that if Shakespeare was on a side, he was on the side of the patriarchy. And yet he gives his female characters some amazing speeches. There's a speech by Emilia in Othello, just extraordinary, that he is able to understand things from her point of view and to make argue. And this was actually a something they did in classical rhetoric called imitatio, they called it, which Shakespeare would have done in school, i.e. being able to articulate the point of view of your enemy. Yeah, so that's something else, another capacity that Shakespeare has. I didn't even discuss that on the course. Maybe I should have, but it's just something else to think about. Okay, so let's have a look. I'll just take a couple of questions here. James White says, what's everybody's favourite Shakespeare? I always say, I mean, I'm not covering the history plays on this course. I started out wanting to do tragedies, histories and comedies, but I thought, actually, the histories are too big a kind of worms to open up here. So I made a decision at one point just to be like, right, four really strong comedies, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, Twelfth Night. Measure for Measure are four meaty plays. Measure for Measure is such a great play. And then the four tragedies, I thought, well, that's enough to go on. You know, of the 37 plays, those eight, if you know those ones well, you're in pretty good stead, you know. But I've always had a soft spot for Richard II. It's been my classic answer. But honestly, working on this, King Lear is just an amazing play. Really is so dark, so bleak and tragic and just unrelenting. And I was quite, before I wrote this course, I was unaware of the fact that in the 60s, there was a whole huge debate that took place. And when you come to do the course, you'll find out about this, where there was a bunch of Christian critics in the early 20th century that, you know, spent a lot of time saying, well, yes, ultimately King Lear is a redemptive play. You know, it might be bleak, but there's a little bit of hope there at the end. And then there are all these critics who came along and said, like, no, you guys are coping. This play gives you nothing. This play is completely black-pilled. It even, you know, it reaches the very depth of human despair. And in the moment where you think salvation is coming, Shakespeare pulls the rug and there's fucking nothing there. Nothing at all. And it's a fascinating debate to read through, because you realize that there in 1960, when they're having this argument, what's really at stake is Western metaphysics. Those Christian critics are like, we need to protect King Lear from these black pillars because we know what's coming. And the black pillars are coming along and saying, no, you guys are misreading this play. There's nothing there. Shakespeare deliberately makes this play without hope. And it's fascinating. And honestly, when I came across that stuff, I was thinking, shit, even I haven't thought about these things. Maybe there is no hope in this play at all. Why did Shakespeare change the source? Why did he kill Cordelia? Why does he pull the rug? Why does he add this guy Gloucester and have his eyes stabbed out? That wasn't in the source text. And then there was a whole debate about two lines right at the end of King Lear about does Lear think Cordelia's still alive? And all these Christian guys are like, look, when he says that, he thinks she's still alive. So he hasn't given up hope. And then all these guys in the 60s are like, you're coping. You lot are coping. That's not in the play. You are coping. He doesn't think she's still alive. She's dead. And he's brokenhearted. And Shakespeare fucking kills him. It's amazing. King Lear is an amazing play. It's an amazing play. Hamlet is an incredible. In fact, all four tragedies are incredible. And working on this made me realize just how good those four plays are. Honestly, Hamlet and Lear are amazing. Macbeth is a masterpiece too. For various reasons, I put Othello as the number four of those, which if you read the, if you get to the Othello part, you'll see, because I talk about, again, a massive debate that took place within Shakespeare studies. All these critics from the 19th century and into the 20th century had noticed that like lots of stuff in Othello doesn't make sense. Like the plot doesn't make a lot of sense. And there are tons of inconsistencies. And I was kind of joking with people as I was writing. I was like, if Othello came out today, there would be a 28-hour mauler thing where Mauler points out all the loopholes and all the things that don't make sense. And Mauler would make a video saying, you know, Shakespeare's lost it. You know, Shakespeare hasn't got what he used to have, you know, with this Othello stuff. But they developed this whole theory called double time to explain away all of these different inconsistencies in the play. And then they said, oh, actually, this double time thing is proof of Shakespeare's genius. And this, like, this is still taught. I was like, what? So at some point, again, in the 50s or the 60s, one scholar comes along and he says, hold on a second. What is all this cope? What are all you guys talking about? Have you missed the fact that clearly he wrote the end of the play first? And then he went away and then he came back and he wrote Act 1 and 2 after some period of time and forgot a ton of stuff. Look, here are literally 50 different inconsistencies. Here's his original source. Here's the, you know, you can clearly see he's not working from the source in Act 1 and 2. You guys are coping, and clearly Shakespeare just made a lot of mistakes here. And I was like, shit, he's right, you know. And, you know, there's tons of stuff like that. On the course, which I came across, which I hadn't really, even I, you know, hadn't really studied in any great depth before. So, this is a thing where you find a lot of people who've got an agenda, who then try to like use Shakespeare to push that agenda in one way or the other, and then they just kind of, you know, just start making things up. Oh, yeah, what he was really doing was there was double time. There's a short time and there's a long time. And this is like, this is a trick that he's playing on the audience. What a genius, you know. There's tons of stuff like that. I also talk quite a lot about contemporary illusions, which should put, you know, by the time you're at the end of this course, if you're one of those people who think that really the plays were written by, you know, Edward de Vere or something, there's a lot of things you're going to have to explain away over the course. I mean, what I really want to happen is for one of those Shakespeare wasn't really Shakespeare guys to take the course and then be like, hold on a second, my dude de Vere died in 1595 or whatever it was, 1593 he died. So how is Shakespeare writing in James the First's era referring to all these things that only happened at that point? Like one of the things that is mentioned in passing, this is, I wasn't like intentionally trying to disprove that argument. But for example, in King Lear, I think it's King Lear. I'd have to double check. I think it's King Lear. They mention that there's been an eclipse. Where there's just a line in passing. Oh, you know, recently there's been an eclipse. It was dark for a while because the sun was covered up by the moon or whatever. And they were like, oh, well, clearly this play came out in 1605 because there was an eclipse in that year. Oh, and look, there's where it was registered in 1606 with a stationer. Oh, look, and there's where it was put on in the court in front of James the First. All right, so this play was written in 1605. Now, if you believe Shakespeare didn't really write the plays, you have to explain away all that stuff. good luck with all of that. So, I mean, the only people who truly believe the Shakespeare wasn't really Shakespeare thing are people who've just not seriously studied this. You know, it is ridiculous to still have that theory. All right, what else? Can I truly understand it if I don't read it in the original German? Shakespeare was not written in German. Shakespeare was written in English, Louis. Shakespeare didn't write German. I don't know if he's trolling or something. You could be thinking of Goethe, but Goethe came after Shakespeare, don't forget. Came after Shakespeare. A lot of Shakespeare's sources were Italian. For whatever reason, he uses the Italian culture was kind of considered high culture in the Renaissance. So a lot of Italian, you'll see a lot of Shakespeare's sources is like, oh, this Italian dude wrote a tale in 1560 and it was translated into English by this dude in 1590 and Shakespeare picked it up. So that's why I've included so much stuff on the sources, because you can actually see directly, all right, so this is the original story that Shakespeare picks up. But so what does he do with that story? What details does he change? What characters does he introduce and which ones does he take out? What plot points does he change? And like I said, in the case of King Lear, he actively strips out all of the bits that would give you hope, right? I mean, there's one version of King Lear where all of the daughters live, right? And Cordelia ends up as the queen. Well, Shakespeare kills all three daughters in his version. In As You Like It, he deliberately works to make the plot worse. There's stuff like, if you look at his original source text, it's like a perfectly nice adventure romance tale, you know, where and Shakespeare just like deliberately makes the plot of As You Like It just worse in every single way. And I think that, and my working theory is that he does that because he's making fun of the genre. He makes it worse because he wants to make fun of pastoral romance. Why? Because by that point it was like very hackneyed old form and Shakespeare was having fun. I also think he was fed up of comedy as well. So there's so many, which is Mrs. A.A.'s favorite. Is she a Shakespeare enjoyer? Mrs. A.A. Studied classics at university. classical civilization or something like that. So her, she likes the class. She likes the Greek classics. She's always going on about, she goes back to the classics. Whenever I mention Macbeth, she brings up Clytemnestra and Agamemnon and all that sort of stuff. So Shakespeare is my favorite American writer. I mean, Shakespeare wouldn't have known what America was, of course. Who is the best Hamlet on film? One of the things that I cannot include on the course due to copyright and so on is clips from films and so on. I also recommend sticking to the BBC Shakespeare because they just stick so closely to the text. Who is the best Hamlet on film? Honestly, I thought that David Tennant Hamlet was very good. The David Tennant Hamlet from about 10 years ago. I'd probably go with the David Tennant, to be honest, if forced. I find the Laurence Olivier's Hamlet is weird. There was a very prevalent reading of Hamlet in Olivier's time that reads the play in an Oedipal way, that Hamlet is obsessed with his mother's sex life because he actually wants to have sex with his mother. And at the start of Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, he actually like kisses his mother straight on the lips, a French kiss, a snog, which is shocking. I don't know. I find Olivier is a bit stagey, to be honest. I mean his plays are his versions of the various plays are iconic, but I think the David Tennant was the best Hamlet in recent times. Well, the best one I can think of. Funny enough, I don't mind Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson's Hamlet is surprisingly good. Mel Gibson is actually pretty good in quite a few of the different Shakespeare adaptations. I don't know whether it's the fact that he gets it or what, but I've got more time for Mel Gibson than I have for Kenneth Branagh, to be honest. That said, I quite like the Michael Fassbender Macbeth, if we have to pick decent films. Any favorite monologues? I like all of Hamlet's soliloquies, but I quite like Hamlet's third soliloquy. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I? I like that one. I really like, there's a speech by Ulysses on Degree, which I was quoting earlier on, which I quite like. Honestly, in Macbeth, the out brief candle, life is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. It's just an amazing speech. So probably one of those. Mel Gibson is also good on some other topics. Yeah, I mean, Mel Gibson, honestly, his Shakespeare is not bad. Do you like Marlowe, says Dr. Faustus. Yeah, I do. I like Dr. Faustus, the play, and Tamburlaine. Where I used to teach both of those, and the Jew of Malta, of course, are all Marlowe plays. I find Marlowe's kind of a bit more bombastic than Shakespeare. And I've studied all of the, I used to teach all of the playwrights from that period: Thomas Kidd, Marston, Middleton, Ben Jonson. Shakespeare is easily the best of them. Easily. I mean, he's just a different league above all of those guys. Dr. Faustus is a masterpiece. Brilliant, brilliant play. What else? Are you aware of the chasiastic structures underlying the speeches and entire plots? You'd have to explain what you mean by that. Off the top of my head, I don't really know what you're talking about. On the course, I look at I deliberately spend a quarter of each lecture looking at structure. You know, the five act Aristotelian structure, Freytag's pyramid for the tragedies. But also when you're looking at dramatic form, structure is about more than simply act structure. It's about how the characters are divided in terms of their social strata, what worlds exist, right? What different spaces are there? So a lot of the plays tend to have like two different spaces. So for example, in Othello, the play starts in Venice, but then it moves to Cyprus, okay? And then there's a third unseen space, which is the Ottoman savage other thing that's lurking in the background, the threat of the Turks just vaguely in the background. And Venice is the city, is a kind of city, and it's civilization, and it's kind of law and order. But Cyprus is kind of a little bit on the edges. It's kind of in between. It's not as secure. It's a little bit in the, you know, on the margins of what you might call civilization. And it's there when things go to shit in Othello, right? So there are these sorts of things. You know, a lot of the comedies have, you know, the forest and the court. And the change of the space actually is part of the structure. In Hamlet, the soliloquies, the seven soliloquies, are actually a structuring principle in the play, which is you know, something that I argue. But then in the course of writing the Hamlet lecture, I discovered that there was a whole period where the famous to be or not to be speech, some people argue that Shakespeare wrote it for himself and then inserted it afterwards. Well, I don't think that's true at all, because if you do a structural analysis, it's directly in the middle of the play. So it's kind of like a hinge point. In Hamlet's kind of mental journey, he has this kind of rising and falling motion. And after the to be or not to be speech is when he kind of resolves to action finally, you know. Humor pill. Yes. Presents two ayahs, A and B, then repeats in reverse order B and A to create an ABBA configuration. What Shakespeare does a lot is that there's often two strands of the action, two plots, an A plot and a B plot, or the main plot and the subplot. And what happens in the subplot parallels what happens in the main plot. Sometimes it's done for comedic effect. Sometimes it's dead straight. So like in King Lear, Gloucester's story directly parallels Lear's story. And there's also, and so when I'm looking at the plays structurally, I'm looking at things like that. And, you know, I suppose that idea that you've just presented is, you know, it's possible that it's playing with that. The Romeo and Juliet version with DiCaprio was kind of funny. Had to watch in school. Yeah, I'm not against that. Nar says Shakespeare is for leftist donuts. I couldn't disagree more. Shakespeare defends hierarchy, order, tradition, standard male female relationships. National pride, all of these things are things that Shakespeare stands for. That it's been subverted by leftists, or that is become leftist coded, maybe. It does not mean that you should just allow them to take Shakespeare from you. And this is one of the reasons why I think that they have won because of attitudes like that, because you're prepared to allow the black lesbian to have Shakespeare. How about no? Because ultimately, these plays speak to us. They speak to you. They don't really speak to her or her concerns at all. But they do speak to your concerns. So, yeah. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous to claim that Shakespeare was a leftist in any respect. One of the true visionaries, of all time. But also, like, it's pretty clear that even in the politics of his own time, he was definitely not a modernist. Shakespeare was with the ancients and not with the moderns. That much is for certain. What is the worst production that I've ever seen? It was a production of Twelfth Night where they were giving out pizza, and the play just kind of devolved into not Twelfth Night, sorry, Midsummer. It was Midsummer Night's Dream. Midsummer Night's Dream, where they were giving out pizza, and the play just kind of devolved into an anarchic mess, which is always a danger with Midsummer Night's Dream, because there's the subplot in that has Bottom and a cast of characters called the Rude Mechanicals, and they can kind of take over the play a little bit, and with a more amateur production or with a production that's trying to be clever, there's a tendency for the comedic actors playing those parts, Bottom, Peter Quince, and just that cast of characters to just kind of just take over, really, and for the whole thing to devolve. And that's what happened in that, where the whole thing kind of collapsed in on itself, and basically everybody was just eating pizza in the audience, and they'd given up, and they were sitting with the audience and eating pizza, and it was like, okay, all right. I mean, whatever you're trying to do, immersive theatre or whatever, I mean, basically you've kind of given up here, haven't you? You know, so that was probably, that didn't work. I mean, most productions you'll see are probably lefty in some way, but some are better than others, right? You know, there was a pretty decent Twelfth Night with Stephen Fry in it a few years back, about a decade ago, which was kind of raved about. Now, undoubtedly, that was leftist in orientation, but it was a pretty traditional production, to be honest, that one. What else? With the Rude Mechanicals, the advice he gives to them are pretty interesting to look at, to get a few insights into Shakespeare's own view of what acting was like. Shakespeare's company was obviously a tip-top. He had top actors in the country at the time working with him. I try to remember that particular production of Midsummer Night's Dream. I remember the actor playing Bottom was sitting in the crowd to start with, and he just had like bags of Sainsbury's shopping with him, and he kind of wanders onto the stage, and then they reveal that actually, you know, he's part of the cast, you know, but to start with, it seemed like he was a member of the audience. Clearly it was good enough for me to remember, but I also remember thinking like, I'm not sure really what they're trying to get at with this. It was fun, but what are those? The Septidile speech is just amazing. And it's right wing, of course. Modern literary classes. The critical theories destroyed the field purposefully. I would agree, and most of the time, they don't even want to talk about Shakespeare, right? What they want to talk about is Marxist theory, or they really want to talk about, feminist theory, or what they really want to talk about is, you know, how it makes them feel as a black woman or something, you know? And this course that I've put together is in some way a corrective against all of that by taking it right back, stripping it right back in a way. to get back to the fundamentals, while also still being scholarly. So, I mean, I'm still talking about A.C. Bradley and G. Wilson Knight and Leavis. And I mean, there are many different theories and critics that made their mark on Shakespeare over the ages. But I don't go beyond 1980 because that's when it really starts to devolve into rubbish, to be honest. Not including my work, of course. yes, Shakespeare has a soft spot for characters in the parallel act until they converge in the final act. I mean, the thing is I have a theory, Daniel, that in his comedies, Shakespeare had lost interest in the comedy. I really believe this, and you'll notice when I cover the comedies, I push my own theories in different bits as well. I'm convinced that by the time Shakespeare was writing As You Like It and Twelfth Night, he'd had enough of like he was just fed up of it. And even by the time of Midsummer Night's Dream, you could argue. And I think he deliberately hijacks his own plots. Right, I think he loses interest in the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream in about Act 3. I mean, the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream is over by about Act 3. And then the play does kind of devolve, right? I mean, okay, they're not giving out pizzas, but you understand what I'm saying. It's like, well, play's kind of ended, but there's still like a half an hour left, whatever. What we're going to do? Well, let's watch this guy as a wall, you know? let's watch the play within the play. But all of the later comedies tend to lose interest in their own plots in that way. So yeah, I'm kind of in. And then in other plays, there is no subplot at all. Like one of the things that's really interesting about Macbeth is that Macbeth is just like all bits. Macbeth is like pure action. Right, we go. Five act, go. Bang, bang, bang. No subplot. Hardly any comedy. You know, it's just all out. And that's why it's so short. It's only like 2,000 lines long. 2,000 lines, yeah, for Macbeth. So, yeah, the structure stuff does matter. How did Shakespeare feel about the Welsh? He certainly includes a lot of Welsh characters in his plays, especially in the history plays when he doesn't need to. So one of the things I've never understood is that in Henry IV, part one, I think it's in part one, they go and visit the Welsh, like a Welsh lord called Owain Glyndwr. They go and visit Owain Glyndwr. And, Hotspur visits Harry Glyndwr. And they're chilling out and they're kind of plotting a rebellion against Henry IV. Okay? So this Welsh lord, Hotspur, and some other dude, they form a triumvirate in rebellion against Henry IV, Bolingbroke. And in that scene, his daughter, Glyndwr's daughter, comes out and starts singing in Welsh. And I've never been understood, like, how did Shakespeare know Welsh? So he must have had a Welsh member of his company, because otherwise, how is there a Welsh song in Henry IV? It's never been explained to me, but presumably he knew somebody Welsh. So it may have been that he had a Welsh cast member, so he kept on writing in Welsh parts, so the Welsh accent wouldn't have been, you know, out of place, or they wouldn't have had to put on an accent or something like that. There's a theory that, yeah, I mean, as somebody's pointing out, all the female roles were played by young boys. The reason for that is because they believe that if you put a woman on stage at somewhere like the Globe, right, in Shakespeare's time, that the groundlings, the peasants who were there, and the lower sort would think that they were prostitutes, and they would try to grab them from the stage. They would try to you know, group them. So for that reason, all of the female parts were played by young boys cross-dressing. And for that reason, for the cross-dressing reason, that's why the Puritans wanted to shut down the theatres, which they did under Cromwell. And even in Shakespeare's time, they were like, what's all this cross, you know, we don't like the cross-dressing, stop doing it. And I think eventually, when the theatres reopened after the Restoration, finally you had women playing on the stage then. But even like that idea that women on stage would be groped took a long time to die out. And I seem to remember that even when they brought the theatres back, they initially were in burlesque shows and sex shows and stuff like that. So there was still a remnant of that idea. But anyway, one of these boy actors, we think, was particularly talented because around the time As You Like It was written in 1599, Shakespeare writes a lot of like really complex female roles. So like in Rosalind in As You Like It is obviously a huge female part, but the boy actor playing Rosalind would have had to have been able to take on a role like that, okay, for one. But then during the course of the play, Rosalind dresses up as a male character called Ganymede. So it's a boy, right, dressed, it's a boy playing a girl who dresses up as a boy. But then while she's disguised as Ganymede, she then plays the part of herself as Rosalind. It's like it's complicated, but it's like a wooing process. So she's trying to get to know this guy Orlando, dressed as a boy, as a disguise, to protect herself because she's run away from the court. But she fancies this guy Orlando. So then, as Ganymede, he gets to know her, and then while they're kind of hanging out as mates, he's like, "Okay, I tell you what, you really like this girl Rosalind. I'll pretend to be Rosalind, and then you can woo me, if you can imagine." But that's a pretty complicated thing for the boy actor to have accomplished. So we think he must have been a pretty good actor to be able to do that. Pretty complicated. What else? We also think Shakespeare played old man roles. Like Shakespeare himself was an actor. We think he played old Hamlet the Ghost, for example, and that maybe he played like some of the angry dads, like in some of the plays. There's usually an angry dad who kicks his daughter out, you know. Shakespeare was not woke. Ridiculous. Do you know some old English? Well, Shakespeare wrote early modern English. Old English is like Beowulf, and then there's Middle English like Chaucer. I did have to learn it when I was doing my exams and things, but it was not my favorite part. And so I did my exams, and then I never went back to the medieval stuff. Because it's basically a different language. So what else? There's a guy called Stephen Greenblatt. I do cover a couple of Greenblatt's theories in the course, because he's the biggest new historicist, and he made quite a mark on Shakespeare studies in the 80s. So there's one or two times where I have to mention him, sadly. Nathan Hurd has asked, did Elizabeth I or James I like plays? I mean, they were known to like Shakespeare's plays, both the monarchs. James I became Shakespeare's patron. So they were the Lord Chamberlain's men. There was a guy called Henry Hudson, who was Shakespeare's patron. But then when James I came to the throne, he actually liked the theatre. And, you know, one of the reasons we think Macbeth is so short is because James I was known to like shorter plays. He didn't like them going on too long. So Measure for Measure is another one that seems like it was written for James, like written to be performed first before the king. And the Lord Chamberlain's men become the king's men. So James must have been a fan because he actually became the patron. So Shakespeare worked directly for the king as the king's playwright. He was still running his own company, and they were still a bit hired on commission by anybody who wanted to hire them out as well. But yeah, they performed a lot at the royal court for James the First. I don't know what James the First's actual views were on the plays. I do know that around the time that Macbeth was written, there was quite a lot of anti-Scottish sentiment in the country. And more than once, James imprisoned people for anti-Scottish bigotry. There's this one dude who starts to rant in Parliament, and James has him arrested for basically calling the Scots savages. So James was pretty, you know, pretty sensitive about anti-Scottish sentiment. I find it a little bit kind of shocking in a way that Shakespeare thought it was a good idea to write a play about basically a psychopath, a psycho Scottish king, Macbeth. But so he does do a few things to appease James. Banquo was Macbeth's, Banquo was James the First's ancestor. And in the source text, Banquo conspires with Macbeth to kill Duncan. And Shakespeare changes that to absolve Banquo of any guilt, because that would have genuinely pissed off James the First. Doesn't seem like Shakespeare and his company got in trouble for Macbeth, but some of Shakespeare's contemporaries, like Ben Jonson and various other people, they wrote a play called Eastward Ho that James the First had banned, and he had Ben Jonson put in jail for stuff connected with writing this anti-Scottish play, right? So that there is a James the First features pretty prominently in the second half when he becomes the king. He is a lot more prominent in Shakespeare's, like as it pertains to Shakespeare, than Elizabeth the First. Although Elizabeth the First did go and watch Shakespeare's plays, and famously she hired the company to perform Richard the Second. She said, I am Richard the Second. Know ye not that?" I've never quite understood why it is that Elizabeth was just all right with the fact that Essex, on the eve of his rebellion, hired Shakespeare and his men to perform Richard the Second. Why they didn't get into trouble, I don't know. But somehow Shakespeare never really got into trouble. I never really understood how he got away with it, but he did. The reason that she says, "I am Richard II, know ye not that," is because Elizabeth I did not have any heirs. Richard II famously did not have any heirs, possibly because he was gay, or so propaganda would have it, that Richard II was gay. And of course, Richard II wasn't a very good king, and he ends up getting usurped by Bolingbroke, Henry IV. And it was widely thought at the time that Shakespeare was cunningly having a dig at this queen, at the Virgin Queen, who didn't have any heirs. And that's why Essex had Richard II put on, because they were going to rebel, just like Bolingbroke rebelled against Richard II. That's why she said, "I am Richard II, know ye not that." Okay. What else have we got here? Let's carry on. Did Shakespeare write Cats? No, he did not. No, he did not write Cats. I don't like Branagh's Hamlet. No, nor do I. Too long. James Lindsay would surely find Shakespeare to be woke. I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would find Shakespeare to be woke. AA, you don't like Branagh? No, not really. No, I don't. I'm just looking through. I'm trying to answer people's questions, so I'm just kind of, and I'll probably wrap up in a second because I'm quite tired. Maybe I'll play a video game or something. What do you think of James Joyce's attempt to surpass Shakespeare? He didn't, did he? Does Shakespeare ever mention the Cornish? I'm sure he does somewhere, but I can't remember off the top of my head if he does mention the Cornish. Nathan Hood said James the First famously hated Macbeth. Did he? Where do you get that from? Where do you get that from? Daniel Hall says, do you think Shakespeare's grief over the loss of his son caused his shift? AA. Well, you're talking about the tragic, dark turn in Shakespeare after... it's after about 1599, really, isn't it? It's Twelfth Night, and then Hamlet, Measure for Measure, and then he just stops writing comedies altogether. They call it the tragic turn, the dark phase in Shakespeare. It has been suggested that actually it's the loss of his father in 1601, together with the loss of his son, who was called Hamnet, in 1596. That really the real dark turn comes after his dad dies in 1601, they think. However, I think he was already on that trajectory in general. There's no doubt that Shakespeare has distinct phases in his career. There's a kind of early phase where he's just kind of finding his feet, and some of those plays are wild, like Titus Andronicus and the Henry VI plays. There's a lot of blood and guts and action in those films, kind of like blockbusters they are. In the middle of the 1590s, there's something called the lyrical period, around the time of Midsummer Night's Dream, Richard II. There's a few different plays around that time which have got a lot more elaborate poetry, and you know, they're a bit more wistful. Then something happens, and he definitely becomes darker. Even his comedies, like Twelfth Night, I mean, it's a comedy, but there's some dark shit in there. And then the so-called problem plays, like All's Well That Ends Well, is dark. Measure for Measure just is, I mean, it's not only unremittingly dark, but it's a comedy, but it's just no jokes, not funny at all. Just like dark, tragic situations. Guy pleading for his life, nun being threatened with rape, and and then Hamlet, and then it gets darker and darker. By the time you get to King Lear and Timon of Athens, it's like Shakespeare's definitely got a moment where he is black pilled to the gills. And then later in life, at the end, by the time of Tempest and Winter's Tale, he somehow finds some sort of magic again and comes out the other side. So his last plays are a bit more magical and a bit more wistful. And they call them his romance period. So there's definitely different moments in his career, and different obsessions that you can notice at different times. And also sometimes he writes plays side by side. So he wrote Antony and Cleopatra and Macbeth at the same time. And you can kind of tell that, oh, that bit from Antony and Cleopatra, you can see it there in Macbeth. And, oh, yeah, he was clearly interested in this. And Timon of Athens and King Lear he wrote at the same time. And they're both just really black pill plays. So, yeah. Let's carry on. My favourite Shakespeare adaptation is Kurosawa's Throne of Blood. Macbeth in feudal Japan. What else? There have been a couple of super chats. I might as well do those before I get out of here. Statius says, is it too simplistic to respond to the claim that Juliet as a strong character proves Shakespeare's enlightened gender perspective by pointing out that her actions lead to her and her lover's death. I mean, no, it's not. I mean, the thing is that the conventions of tragedy is that everybody dies, and the conventions of comedy is that everybody gets married. Okay. Now, just because you get these occasional strong female characters does not mean necessarily that Shakespeare is a feminist. And it, in fact, it's almost always the case that by the end of the play, Shakespeare is restoring, like, most of the time he's coming back on the side of the status quo or the order, most of the time. That said, there is this recurring issue in his plays of the unruly daughter. And I mean, one thing we know, Shakespeare was a dad himself. He had two daughters, Susanna and what was his second daughter called? Was she called Juliet? I can't remember what his second daughter was called. This is a recurring problem where you get the angry dad, like you get the dad who does not like the daughter's choice of mate for one reason or another, and there's conflict over it. It's a trope he goes to on at least like 10 occasions, if not more. So it's clearly something that he had like some issue with that he kept on coming back to. In fact, this is one biographical detail that is relevant. In Shakespeare's will, he has his daughter's husband written out of his will. Specifically says, if this dude gets any, like, he is not to have a single penny of any part of my estate, writes him out of the will. So he clearly just didn't like his own son-in-law. So that is a kind of funny little detail. Matt Bell says, if you put your Devon Stack hat on and reviewed Shakespeare's greatest hits, what debauchery do you think he would find? I mean, there's tons of... when you say debauchery, it depends on what you mean. There's quite a lot of... I mean, there's quite a number of rape scenes, and there's quite a number of gratuitously violent scenes. Titus Andronicus is his most... I mean, it's his ridiculous play where somebody is baked into a pie and fed to their own family, and a woman's arms are replaced with twigs and trees, and there's just gratuitous rape in that particular play. At the start of Titus Andronicus, Titus just kills one of his own sons, you know. That is a wild Tarantino-esque play. So I'm sure there's tons of, like, in terms of violence, you'd find tons of it. In terms of debauch, in that sense, like when it comes to, like, there's very little. He likes his old sexual puns, and there's a kind of few crude jokes here and there where, there's a pun on, you know, various genital parts or whatever, but in general, I don't think Shakespeare is much on the old debauch front, to be honest. Niccolo says, I just bought the course today. Could you consider re-releasing your old Shakespeare podcast? There are only 3 episodes left online. I don't know what happened to those episodes. I don't have them anymore. They're lost as far as I know. They've kind of disappeared. If anybody ever kind of saved them all, if you send them to me, I'll get them back up. But as far as I know, they're lost. Shakespeare's Tarantino phase. I mean, definitely. Around 1593, I mean, in Henry VI Part Two, there's a scene in which there's a rebellion, and the heads of these two town officials are severed, and then they hold the two heads and make them make the two heads kiss. He went through an incredibly violent phase when he early on. So there was that. Using Tarantino to describe Shakespeare, but why not? I'm just trying to think of who else is as gratuitously violent. If you watch Titus Andronicus, I guarantee you, you'll understand what I mean by the Tarantino Shakespeare. What else have we got? Did Hamlet smoke cigars? I don't think they had cigars. One of the things you were talking about, James the First was had this theory that tobacco was harmful in some way, and that I'm trying to remember exactly what it is he believed about tobacco, but that is something that Shakespeare found a way to weave into, because they were just discovering tobacco, weren't they, at the time. And I think actually, was it Walter Raleigh who was the first person to bring cigars back? So I think they were like brand new on the scene. They smoked pipes rather than cigars at this time, I believe. James the First believed that tobacco had, or he was interested to find out if tobacco had medical uses, and also whether breast milk had any effect on the development of a child's character. And Shakespeare, we think, read some of James the First's writing before he, because you got to remember, like, his mate has just been put in jail, he at least knew Ben Jonson. He'd just been put in jail. You've got this new Scottish king. You're writing a play about Scotland. He's like, I better make sure that I don't, put a foot wrong here. So he inserts all these little things. James was into witchcraft and, lo and behold, there's some witches there. But he also inserts these things about breast milk and, a little reference to, tobacco being used as medicine, etc. So, but I'm pretty sure it's Walter Raleigh who brought the pipe tobacco back to England around this time. Walter Raleigh is an interesting figure. I don't talk about this on the course, but Walter Raleigh developed a kind of nationalist economics around this time. Like he's been exploring, and he's like, "Oh, we shouldn't have free trade. We need to close the borders. We need to keep the French out." So Walter Raleigh is kind of like a proto-nationalist. He'd be an interesting figure for people to look into. I think he got into trouble quite a few times with the authorities, Walter Raleigh, but he's an interesting character, to say the least. In Blackadder, probably Flashart is meant to be Raleigh, isn't he? Smoke me a kipper, I'll be back for breakfast. but I'm pretty sure that there's a picture of Raleigh with a pipe, because he I think is the one credited with bringing tobacco back. What else have we got? Spasticus Autisticus says, "I've always loved the character of Polonius and his interactions with Hamlet. Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel?" Yeah, Polonius is a funny character. Now you see, this is the funny thing. Even though I've really gone to town on this, the plays have got so much in them that I could easily have written another 8 lectures on those plays with completely different points, with completely different things, and I would still have got, 6,000-7,000 words on each play. So, for example, my discussion of Hamlet barely even mentions Polonius, apart from in passing, because it's not the focus of what I'm talking about. But yeah, Polonius is a great character. Great character. All right. I think that'll do, ladies and gentlemen. Sir Walter is actually himself in Blackadder 2. There's an episode where Blackadder discovers New Guinea. Or is there? Is there really? Okay. I haven't rewatched Blackadder in a while. So maybe I should. Judith was, Judith is the name of Shakespeare's daughter. All right. Well, anyway, pick up Foundation. I'll play my little trailer again. Jan should still be working. Let's see what I really make of this trailer. Let's have a look.
If music be the food of love, play on.
Foundations of Shakespeare.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Oh, look, here comes Othello, talking total crap as usual.
14 lectures.
But it is a melancholy of mine own, compounded of many simples, extracted from many objects.
Buy it now! Simon Roberts, great voice. Great voice. I was just a first pass. Maybe I'll kind of do a number of different remixes when I get time. But now I'm going to collapse in a heap and possibly play a game of some sort. I'm feeling pretty knackered, so maybe it will be something gentle, something cozy, maybe. Let's have a look at my games list. What's a cozy game I can play? I might give a go of that Winkelet, the little shop. Maybe I'll give that a go. Just running my own little kind of weapon shop in the corner of an RPG world. That sounds cozy because I'm just so tired. I'm probably going to fall asleep in a minute. I'll be back tomorrow with our Adam Curtis review with a man himself, Simon Roberts. And I think our premier heel, Horace, will be back. So catch us for that. And I'll see you soon. Pick up Foundations of Shakespeare today. Get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.